A record 969 million citizens called to the polls for what some see as a referendum about a single man. India's about to embark on the world's biggest election, staggered over 7 weeks with Narendra Modi's Hindu nationalist BJP favored to stretch its solid lead in parliament. Modi's been pointing to a decade of unprecedented growth and power for a nation courted by the West and beyond. The opposition warns of growing inequality and democratic backsliding. Court cases deemed political dog its leader Rahul Gandhi, as well as the popular chief minister of Delhi, who's currently in jail for alleged ties to a corruption case. So, as India moves from the country to the city, as the literacy rate rises, what kind of a democracy is it? And what does the majority of its 1.4 billion people want? Today in the France 24 debate, we're looking ahead to India's general election. Joining us from the capital, New Delhi, Rajat Sethi, visiting fellow at the India Foundation think tank. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, good evening, everyone.
Jean-Luc Racine, senior fellow at the Asia Center think tank. Welcome back to the show.
Good evening.
France 24's Jalila Jacinto, senior editor at France24.com. You've been reporting on these elections there for us. How are you?
Good. Good to be here.
Your reactions on the hashtag F24 debate. It's a marathon, not a sprint. Voting spread out over 44 days across India's 28 states and union territories. 543 constituencies up for grabs. Polling stretches from Friday to this Friday to June the 1st. There you see all seven phases on this map of India, with the results to be announced the following Monday on June the 4th. The BJP got 303 seats last time around and hopes to do better this time.
They have improved the country's infrastructure. They have created more jobs. They have integrated the country into a digital economy. Those are the pros of the government. And the cons of the government are the religious rift that is happening, the communal discord that is seen all throughout India.
There's not going to be a job lack in your future, and there's not a safety net for youngsters, and we need new skills that that we will need in the upcoming future.
I will not vote for the BJP because they did not address the rights of the farmers, and justice has not been served to many farmers who lost their lives during the protests.
Okay, so there you hear some dissenting voices, but Jean-Luc Racine, the BJP hoping to go from, what is it, 303 seats to more than 400. What's this election about?
Well, it's an election first about Modi, because, of course, what's characterized India those days is the focus on the Prime Minister. And we had a good example of that when the Ram Temple in Ayodhya has been inaugurated, not by a high priest, but by the Prime Minister.
This was back in January.
Back in January. And when we see also his portrait everywhere in Delhi when there was the G20 presidency, or everywhere in the electoral manifesto of the BJP. And of course, what's striking, I think, this time is that the focus on the BJP is not just the program, it's the program which is guaranteed, quote unquote, by the Prime Minister. And in the list of the topics which have to be addressed in case of victory, each of these topics for the poor, for the ladies, for the fishermen, for the farmers, for the young, for the old, each time there is the guarantee of Modi. So it's really a kind of competition which superimposes the relevance of the leader. Because as Modi himself has said, the times globally are difficult. So India is supposed to need a strong government. And a strong government is, of course, the result of a strong vote from the people and a strong government led by a strong leader. This, of course, opens a space for the opposition, which may criticize this kind of hyper-personalization of the leadership. and also on the question of how democracy is turning to be whatever the...
Is there a precedent for this, where power in India has been associated so much with one single individual? When you think back to the Indira Gandhi days, for instance.
Yeah, of course, during Indira Gandhi days, there was a kind of sycophant in the Congress who said, India is Indira, Indira is India. But now it's more than that. I mean, we have not to take too seriously every statement by some BJP supporters. But after Ayodhya, there were some BJP militants who say, well, now we have a new incarnation of God Ram, and so Modi has been painted as being the 11th avatar of the deity, but it's not representative, of course, of what the average Indian is thinking about. But the stakes are very important about two conceptions of what India is supposed to be. And this raises, of course, the question of what would happen in case of a pronostic of a third victory is confirmed, and under which condition it will be confirmed. Because, as you said, Modi was saying first, we want to have 370 seats, which was, of course, a reference to the constitutional article 370, which was referred to for... changing the fate of Kashmir in 2019. Then we say perhaps 400 seats. I think this is important because if he doesn't reach this number, he may be victorious. But behind that, the real issue is what are the preliminaries necessary in terms of number of MPs for eventually changing the constitution.
Eventually changing the constitution if they get a supermajority. Jean-Luc Racine there mentioning that back in January, India's prime minister opening that Hindu temple built on the ruins of a historic Mughal-era mosque in the northern town of Ayodhya. We discussed it on this very set at the time. Rajat Sethi, you know, there's this old mantra that politicians like to use, which was unity through diversity. Is that being replaced in India? Is today India, you know, a Hindu majority nation, and that's the way it should be seen?
Well, India's secular credentials are very much intact and are strengthened. The temple movement has been going on for the past three decades. Indian, and especially the majority Hindus in India, patiently went through a proper legal process right from the lower court to the highest courts in India. And when the highest court upheld that the mosque was built on an original temple was when the Hindus were handed over the land. And the temple was built, there was completely peace atmosphere in the whole country, which further suggests that all communities welcomed court's decision and ensured a beautiful temple is built, wherein not just the Hindus, but also the Muslims community in India, not just appreciated it, they also came at the inauguration. So this is plain and simple secular credentials of the Indian state as such remains intact, and I don't see any kind of fear-mongering there is going to affect our fabric, one. Number two, I just heard the previous gentleman speak about supermajority. Well, the Indian citizen is all geared up to hand over yet another mandate to Prime Minister Modi, and he has categorically said that any kind of fear-mongering or dog-whistling by certain miscreants that the Constitution would be changed is misplaced. He has underscored this, that the rights of all communities would remain intact. Our Constitution and the basic structure of our Constitution cannot be changed. The Supreme Court has held this for a very long time now, more than five decades. and that remains the law of the land. You cannot change the secular fabric just by changing or altering the constitution. So I would suggest read about India's constitutional jurisprudence to arrive to a conclusion that what can Modi do with the supermajority. So I think I would request the previous speaker to also deep dive and look at a deeper sort of an analysis to reach to a conclusion.
Let me bring you in on this then. Is the India of today the same as 10 years ago when it comes to its identity as a secular state?
No, it isn't. I mean, after a decade of Modi in power, there are fundamental changes. The Modi decade has been characterized by economic growth. I'm sure we're going to talk about that. But also hyper-nationalism, which comes with a crackdown on free speech and anybody disputing the line. Hindu majoritarianism, brand Modi, and also social welfare. To talk about the Ayodhya Mosque. I mean, there were a couple of things on the BJP's manifesto that kept coming up for years. And a lot of people thought these are just talking points. You know, this is just the BJP's platform. It's not going to be done. The revoking of Kashmir's status, the article of the constitution, which was revoked. So that was a constitutional change. The building of the Ayodhya Mosque, which sent an incredible signal to India's minority Muslim community. It's a message not only of the change in the narrative, to tell people that the Muslims were happy with this. You know, this has been a long-standing a dispute, an extremely touchy dispute. But it also shows the changes in the institutions in 10 decades in power. So, this is not...
But to Rajat's point that there are checks and balances in India and the constitution won't be changed if there's a supermajority.
It's arguable what the checks and balances are in India. I mean, there is hardly much opposition. A lot of these most controversial measures were pushed through parliament. The BJP and its allies has 303 seats in parliament. Not much debate and not much of an opposition, partly because of its own internal weaknesses, but very much because the opposition has been completely targeted. And this is no secret, even for international viewers who are not paying much attention to India. You know, they are seeing chief ministers from the opposition being arrested, you know, what is called right now in India tax terrorism. So people who are from the opposition get targeted by the powerful enforcement directorate. So there is a steady decrease in a lot of democratic milestones in India.
Let me ask you about this, Rajat Sethi, because you have the leader of the Congress party. He's accusing the BJP of freezing campaign funds and restricting travel. Rahul Gandhi, who is had a 2-year prison sentence for defamation, suspended, but it's not completely been wiped from the book. So it's there as a sort of Damocles. And then there's the Delhi chief minister, Arvind Kejriwal. He remains in custody on allegations his party received kickbacks while handing out liquor licenses to private companies. Does he deserve to be held behind bars? Is he a flight risk?
This election is a fight between two blocs. On the one side, there is the National Democratic Alliance, which wants to remove the corrupt. On the other hand, there is another bloc that wants to protect the corrupt. Now you, the people, have to choose.
That was a few days ago. Narendra Modi on the campaign trail in Uttar Pradesh. Rajat Sethi, this accusation that the opposition's being hounded, your reaction to that?
I think the law is catching up, especially the Delhi chief minister is accused of a very big crime associated with liquor policy.
But should he be in jail? He hasn't even been formally charged.
Yeah, so the Indian legal system went through the process of bail application, and it found out that the primary evidence is put forth builds a strong prima facie case against the Delhi chief minister, and him being powerful can tamper with the evidence. This is what the court's observations were, and the court and the highest courts of our country, by the way, deemed it fit to keep him under the judicial custody. He's not being jailed. He's in the judicial custody till the investigation is not complete. Once the investigation moves into the trial phase, he will be released. There can't be special rules for the opposition and vis-a-vis a common man. The parity and a level playing field has to be there. So I think this is point number one. Point number two on Rahul Gandhi, suggesting that his accounts have been freezed. First of all, there was a lien on the account only for the amount that the income tax authorities have been asking his party to submit. For the past more than a decade, there have been summons after summons to Rahul Gandhi and his party that they need to comply with the summons and provide the returns. Every political party in India needs to submit its tax returns. They did not do it over and over again. And there were claims from the tax authorities, and then they put a lien on his account. And this can't be called hoards, because these are the institutions of our country simply catching up, and they have given them enough time. For example, Arvind Kejriwal, he skipped summons of the Enforcement Directorate 9 times. It did not happen in the middle of the election. It happened way past, one right. year back. So him saying that it is because of the elections I've been arrested, that is wrong.
Let me turn to Jean-Luc Racine, the optics of all of this, seen from the outside. But you heard the government's view that this is just due process, this is the law, and the opposition saying, why are all our leaders under judicial threat?
I mean, it's precisely the government view, you know, and that's true that Kejriwal, the chief minister of Delhi, failed to answer a convocation for a number of times. But for freezing the financial resource of the main opposition party during the campaign, it's quite different, because if there was really a serious problem, why the serious problem would not have been addressed 1 year or 2 years before? So we have to go beyond that, I think. I can reassure Mr. Setti that I have read the Constitution. I know that it will be difficult to change it, but I know that the Prime Minister has said we shall not change it. But there is quite a number of question marks about, beyond the Constitution, the spirit of the Constitution. And as it was said before, there is a change which is a matter of concern for a number of people, and not just foreign observers. But the real issue is to know and to explain why Narendra Modi is so popular. And is it just a question of a number of welfare decisions which have been taken? And here again, of course, there is a debate about up to which extent it's effective or not, but let's not enter into that. And what's striking me is that for months, of course, we heard about Hindutva, about Ayodhya, the religion. But if we look closely at the election manifesto of the BJP, which has been released just a few days ago, it's basically focused on socioeconomic issues, because it's on those issues that the opposition is trying to put the finger on, saying, for instance, Modi had promised to double the income of Indian farmers. And we have seen dozens of thousands of farmers protesting against a proposed law changing the rule of agricultural markets, and Modi finally has to go back. And similarly, when Modi has proposed during the last campaign that there would be 20 million jobs created every year, here now the opposition is saying, but one of the key issues of India is not just, of course, the Indian economic growth, but the disconnect between the size of the growth, which put India ahead most of the big countries, but
also the inequality. Sadly, Jean-Luc Racine.
Inequality and unemployment.
And sadly, Jean-Luc Racine, it's a curtailed edition due to a strike, so we're going to have to leave it there for now. But I want to thank you so much. I want to thank Lila Jacinto. Frustratingly short. We'll have, I hope, over the next 7 weeks, chance with Rajit Sethi in Delhi to talk about it more. Thank you for being with us here in the France 24 debate.